And yeah, I would say anymore. The moderator is Mariela Voites. And then we've got three panelists, and she'll be able to tell you a bit about them. It's going to be the same format as the last time. We'll have about 10 to 15 minutes of speaking for each panelist, and then we'll have hopefully a pretty lengthy question period so we can get some good dialogue.
Thank you, everybody. Good evening here, and be ready for the second part of our conference. Thank you, Catherine, for inviting us and making this possible and continue this effort with the third conference of the International Humanitarian Law in Habitat. And you have in the program the bio of the one of the persons that is in the table here. I just want to give the names and a small presentation. Nancy Ingram. Nancy is a manager of the Organization Development Program for Mine Action Canada, and she is the first person who is coming.
Thank you. I'm very happy and pleased to be invited. I work for Canada's campaign to ban landmines and cluster bombs, so it's called Mines Action Canada. And my part, I've been charged, Chris and I switched, to give you a quick clusters 101 for those of you that are not versed in what they are and what the problems are with them, and then let you know a little bit about what is happening internationally and what we're working towards as a campaign in Canada. So I'll try and cram it all in. Mines Action Canada was originally founded as the Canadian partner to the international campaign to ban landmines, and our mandate is to work on eliminating the impacts of victim-activated weapons. So cluster munitions has now fallen into that impact. We are part of the leadership of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, and we are a founder and part of the leadership of the Cluster Munition Coalition, so the new coalition working on clusters. So that's who we are. So essentially, cluster bombs are weapon systems. They're not just a weapon, they're weapon systems, and probably the best way to describe kind of what they are is like peas in a pod. So they're weapon systems that contain dozens to hundreds to occasionally thousands of submunitions or cluster bomblets. They can be dropped in the air or they can be delivered by artillery from the ground. Cluster bombs are wide area effect weapons, so they are designed to go over a wide area, and there was a military utility, which I'll get to originally. The container kind of opens up in the air and they scatter the bomblets, again, depending on how many bomblets are in this particular cluster munition system, and that can be over 2 to 4 football fields. So we're talking quite a large dispersal. So cluster bombs were first used in World War II, and they were used by Germany in England. And actually, there were humanitarian concerns reportedly when they were first used as well. This is a picture of kind of a risk education poster, and it was alleged by our colleagues at Landmine Action UK that, in fact, that England tried to have a publication ban on the effect of cluster munitions that have been scattered in northern England, not for any kind of strategic purposes, but they didn't want the Germans to know about the civilian disruption. So that was kind of the first time that there were issues, humanitarian issues, flagged with cluster munitions. Originally, the military utility of a cluster munition, and Chris can correct me if I don't get this exactly right, is essentially for symmetrical threats, so like rows of tanks, you know, during the Warsaw Pact era, aircraft could, you know, try and destroy a row of tanks with one pass using multiple bomblets as opposed to having to make 5 passes using a unitary bomb, so thus exposing its craft to anti-aircraft fire. So that's kind of the original, my understanding, the original military utility of cluster bombs. So just to kind of give you an idea, we have 4 kind of core humanitarian concerns about cluster bombs. And the first concern is its impact on civilians at the time of use. To give you a sense of the impact, or the footprint is what it's called, this is an aerial view, which I guess you can't really see that well, of Parliament Hill, with Parliament Hill being the white tower at the top. Okay, so the next slide shows you a red grid and an orange grid. And this is the size of a typical strike that was used in Kosovo. So this is an example of a strike that was used similar to what was done in Kosovo. So 3 cluster bombs, each containing about 600 bomblets. Now the red area, so if you were aiming to say at a row of tanks in front of Parliament Hill or something like that, the red area is the area estimated to be impacted if everything went exactly according to plan. So if there were no errors in target delivery, there was no kind of weather conditions that influenced it, etc. The orange area, which you see, is what happens if there is something that goes wrong in the delivery or the dissemination. So pilot error, like I said, wind or weather conditions, etc. So you see, even if things go exactly according to plan in an urban area, you can have significant impact on civilians. So the West Block of Parliament is taken out a little bit down to the Supreme Court, and there's a pedestrian mall across the street from Parliament Hill, just to give you a sense of the impact when things go exactly right, and when things, you know, for whatever reason, and errors are made, go a little bit wrong. So that gives you a sense of what the footprint of a cluster strike can be. So in modern conflicts, we kind of contain that in the way the clusters have been used for the past 30 years, in almost every occasion, you don't really have that situation that you had during the Cold War eras of columns of tanks, you know, over the plains of Europe. And it seems to us in our research that military trends currently point away from all this type of Cold War warfare. So if we consider the actual use of cluster bombs in the last 30 years, they've often been used in compensation for the lack of ability to hit targets with precision. In Vietnam's, Laos, and Cambodia's, cluster bombs were used against a dispersed guerrilla force hiding in dense forest. In the latest conflict in Iraq, a coalition force used cluster bombs against unseen fighters hiding in urban areas. So they're not actually, in the last 30 years, being used for how they were designed anyway, in our opinion, and it's more often than not, which has caused unacceptable civilian casualties. They're often used because it's what's loaded on the pallets, is our information from the different military we've been able to talk to. Like, if it's on the pallets, they're going to use it, whether it's the best weapon or not, because it's what they have. And it's not always clear to us, and in the research and in the ICRC meeting that happened in March last year, where they brought together technical experts, both government and independent, that it's not always clear to us, and I think that was also the finding of the report, that the case was made that the military utility was always, the military strategic objective was always met. And this is a quote from, you know, a general saying that the 78,000 UK cluster bombs, perhaps we had an impact of taking out about 30 pieces of military targets or activity. So the second main humanitarian concern that we have is what happens after a strike. Because of the large number of bomblets contained in particular cluster munition systems, and that all weapons do have failure rates, we would argue that there are a lot of clusters that have higher than posted failure rates. There's a lot of problems that happen like post-conflict, and it's very similar to the concerns that we had with landmines. When these weapons fail to detonate as planned, they essentially have to be treated as landmines, de facto landmines, and it denies people's ability to rebuild after a conflict. It denies people access to land, access to returning home. It becomes a significant barrier to post-conflict reconstruction. So the presence of unexploded bomblets puts lives and livelihoods, just like landmines and personal landmines, at risk long after the conflict is ended. And Human Rights Watch has a list of what they call the 12 dirty dozen of the most unreliable and inaccurate cluster munitions. Canada possessed two of the dirty dozen. It's in the process of destroying one, and it is committed to destroying its other stockpile of cluster munitions, but we have no confirmation of when that will take place. So that's the second concern. What is the impact on civilians after a conflict has ended? And it is very similar to any personal landmine. So again, this is just an example of a cluster munition at a watering hole that's being used regularly. And again, you have to treat all failed munitions as live until they are determined elsewise. So you never really know what's alive and what's dead. So this is an example of Lebanon. So Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, in the July 2006 conflict, there were an estimated 4 million sub-munitions dropped. It is estimated that 1 million of those are lying on the ground now, that they did not explode as intended, and they are laying as duds. And it is preventing people from the harvest, and it will continue to prevent people from returning back to productive use of the land until they are all cleared. So this is an example of an artillery-delivered cluster bomblet. This one contains a self-destruct mechanism. Some of the arguments that have come forth when we've been trying to, and we've been working on trying to get some type of ban on cluster munitions since 2000, are that technical solutions may be the option. And one of the arguments for improved ones that have either self-neutralization or self-destruct mechanism. This is an example of a cluster munition with a self-destruct mechanism that did not go off in southern Lebanon. And then there's an example of three more cluster bombs that have self-destruct mechanisms that did not go off. So not only do you have one kind of explosive that has failed to detonate, now you have two. So again, it's a double danger. It becomes de facto landmine. And cluster bombs are meant, unlike landmines, cluster bombs are meant to like basically take out a tank or pierce armor. So the explosive in a cluster munition is much more lethal than that as a landmine. Landmines were designed to maim or injure kind of, and specifically a person, to take out soldiers off of the battlefield. So the lethal charge in these is a little more volatile and a lot more explosive. The kill ratio or killer injury ratio with a cluster munition accident or explosion is about 2 to 3 people per incident. So to us, this illustrates that technical solutions are not the answer to addressing the cluster problem. Let's just see an example of an artillery-delivered cluster ball, so you get a sense of the explosion. So unexploded cluster bombs do not just litter the ground, like landmines, but especially in Lebanon, like the kinds with the ribbons or bows are found hanging in trees, and Lebanon is very dense with olive groves and banana trees and whatever, which makes the clearance of these that much more difficult. On average, it takes between 18 and 21 hours to clear a single bomblet. And again, deminers, although they use very similar techniques to that of clearing landmines, there's the added danger because they're that much more volatile and they have that much more of an explosive charge. So they're very difficult to clear, even though you can see them unlike landmines. Doesn't seem to make much difference. Another kind of, our third concern is the track record of cluster bomb use. It's been well documented for over 30 years by various human rights groups, Human Rights Watch, Handicap International, etc., that almost every time cluster bombs have been used in the last 30 years, in our opinion, they have been used irresponsibly. And this could be Lebanon in 2006, Iraq in 2003, Afghanistan in 2001, 2002, and Southeast Asia in the 1960s and 70s. We've also found that they have, again, regularly been used in huge numbers and in populated areas in the past 30 years. We also know that old and outdated models have been used even when new models are available. And again, the most recent example would be Lebanon, where there's been cluster munitions found that have expiry dates, you know, dating to 1974, you know, which again increases the volatility and instability of the weapon. So although we feel that IHL provides for the protection of civilians against conflict and that technically we feel that this should be covered under IHL, existing IHL, it's clear that right now, as Isabel was talking about, there's a gap. There's a gap and we need additional supplementation to IHL to address this issue. Handicap International reports that about 98% of the casualties, and these are casualties recorded, and the data is difficult to collect because we are operating in post-conflict situations and situations or contexts where, you know, maybe reporting and data collection is not very easy to do. But of what Handicap International has been able to record, 98% of the casualties recorded have been civilians, and a third of those have been children. Most of the injuries have occurred when people were conducting normal kind of livelihood activities, you know, in usual and accustomed places. So that's also significant to us. This is just an example of, again, another child that was injured and he was injured in his house in Iraq. So again, the use of cluster munitions in populated areas has significant toll on the population. And the track record for use of cluster munitions responsibly is, it doesn't exist as far as we're concerned. Okay, since 1999, even though we have known and the international community has actually had concerns about cluster munitions since the Vietnam War, millions of submunitions have been dropped since 1999 in Iran, Afghanistan, Kosovo, and Lebanon. In recent conflicts, like I said, cluster munitions with knowingly high failure rates or ones that are part of the Dirty Dozen of Human Rights Watch have been knowingly used. What is interesting is that what Chris will speak to is the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which is the UN body that determines like what is acceptable to use in war and what is not acceptable to use as a weapon, was actually founded or states came together because of concerns raised back in the 70s over cluster munition use in Southeast Asia. But because of the way the CCW operates and various other political structures, for 30 years they have failed to address, even though that was their reason for forming the body, cluster munitions adequately. So our final concerns about cluster bombs from a civil society perspective is the future harm that they could cause. Right now, they have been confirmed use in 29 countries and territories, and there have been 14 countries that have been confirmed to have used cluster munitions. But however, there are 74 countries that currently stockpile the weapon, including Canada. But like I said, they have declared their intention to destroy their stockpiles, and 34 have been known to produce it. So we are talking about billions of submunitions in the world's stockpiles. So even though where they have been used, they have caused predictable and foreseeable damage to civilians, we actually feel, and we have felt, the community has felt, you know, since the Vietnam War, that we are actually in a window of preventing a humanitarian crisis that would far surpass that of landmines. The 2006 Lebanon-Israel conflict also marked the first confirmed use, although there have been allegations of use, of a non-state armed group. So Hezbollah used clusters against Israel. Obviously not on the same scale, but that, for us, you know, sparks further concerns about proliferation of this weapon. So we feel that if something is not done finally now, and again, it is not a new issue, Lebanon has pushed it to the forefront because of the devastation caused in Lebanon, but the story is the same if you trace it back for 30 years. We just have a unique opportunity to prevent predictable humanitarian crisis that will cost us all a lot more money in clearance and a lot more lives. So that's kind of where we are now. So what is being done? Well, with the conflict in Lebanon, although this has been on the CCW, which is the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons agenda, especially since 2000 as a mandate, Lebanon's really kind of pushed the action to the fore, and last November was the review conference of the CCW. And at that time, certain states, and definitely civil society, declared the CCW a failure, similar to how they did with landmines 10 years ago. It was the review conference, it was their final time to try and address the issue. Very little progress was made. There was a protocol, all in that 6 years, the only progress was made was a protocol on the cleanup of explosive remnants of war, which actually don't really address our concerns at the time of the strike, and a lot of the provisions are largely voluntary for cleaning up. So basically, CCW was declared a failure by civil society and some states within the CCW, and it was Norway, who again, very much how Canada did with landmines, that stepped up and offered to lead a process outside of the CCW, and that is called the Oslo process. First couple of meetings have happened with states. We have 80 states that have now signed on to the Oslo process, which is basically a commitment to negotiate a new treaty by the end of 2008. Canada was originally, there was a question of whether Canada was going to be in the room at the beginning of the Oslo conference. Canada did make it in the room, and in the end they did commit to the declaration, but they have not played an active role, they have not played a leadership role, and it is unclear as to whether Canada is going to be a player in this or just in the room, and that is where our work has come. So the first negotiations for this treaty will start officially in Vienna in December, and our role as Canadian civil society is to basically ensure that Canada is active in the room and has a good negotiating mandate. And that's where a lot of our work is coming in. Mines Action Canada has a petition, which it's handing over to the government on December 3rd, which is on the front table, and you can get some from me, which is the 10-year anniversary of the day the world came to Ottawa to sign the landmine treaty. And it's basically urging them to take both national leadership, and in national leadership we are asking for a moratorium to be officially declared. Because Canada does not produce cluster munitions, it actually never used the ones it had, and my information is we actually couldn't afford to test them. And we are destroying our stockpiles. So we feel this is a very easy way for Canada to show leadership and goodwill. It matches what's being done in other countries. And then the rest of our work is to ensure that the treaty that ends up being negotiated becomes a living treaty instead of just words on paper. The framework currently is the Ottawa Convention framework that's being looked at as the model for the treaty, which we think is a really good start, but it also will help us improve upon some of the weaknesses in the Ottawa Treaty, like obligations to victims who have been affected, and joint operations from reporting and monitoring. So what can you do if you want to get active in Canada? There's a list of actions. Mostly, the simplest thing you could do today is sign the petition. Like I said, it should be presented to the House of Commons on December 3rd. The other thing you can do is contact your MP and let them know what you think about the issue and what you would like Canada, what kind of role you would like Canada to play, both nationally and internationally, in this process. Just like the landmine issue, it was actually Canadian civil society, and you know, at the beginning, and the amount of letters and phone calls, and even our colleagues that were at Foreign Affairs at the time said it was the deluge of letters to MPs that, you know, really pushed Canada forward to basically step out of business as usual, you know, which was a big risk for us politically, and decide to negotiate a treaty anyway. So civil society is really needed again at this point, and it can be as simple as just letting your MP know exactly what you think about the issue and what you want to do. We have a toolkit which is online, which is basically everything you need to know, and different resources, presentations, videos to take action on the issue. And I encourage you to speak to me afterwards if you want to find out more about what you can do. And that's it.
Thank you very much. In the second and the other speaker, Happy Mountain, is the mayor, Christopher King, and he is a reserved officer serving in the direction of the Strategic Legal Analysis Office of the Judge Abbott.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you, and to Catherine and Greg Cross and Salsa for putting this up on Saturday. I think that's a really good introduction there. It provides a pretty solid base, and there's a lot of points of agreement in my presentation and the one you just heard. As is mentioned in the bio, I've been involved in the cluster munition issue since the beginning of the Oslo process. I was a member of the delegation to Oslo, the Canadian delegation to Oslo, and to the follow-up meeting in Lima. And I've also been involved in the CCW side, the meeting of a group of governmental experts this summer, and expect to be sort of involved with this process as it goes forward. And what I expect that my presentation to do, or what I intended to do anyway, is to outline some of the key legal issues that are at play in both of these processes, because there are obviously some pretty significant similarities between the two. And also, I'd like to talk a little bit about the rationale for involvement in both of those processes. And Canada is committed to both the CCW and to the Oslo process as well. To begin, it is clear to me as well that there are serious humanitarian concerns with some types of cluster munitions. And that's most clearly evidenced by the recent conflict between Israel and Hezbollah that was fought primarily over southern Lebanon. But it's equally clear to me that the answer is likely not a complete ban on all types of weapons that employ explosive submunitions. I'll come back to the reasons for that in a minute, but there are some 200 different types of cluster munitions, and there are significant distinctions between them that are important, I think, to talk about. But before I go any further, I will re-echo a point that's already been made, that Canada hasn't used cluster munitions, at least as they're commonly understood. It has used things like chaff, which is an anti-aircraft, or an anti-aircraft missile system, and illumination, and propaganda, all of which are delivered by something that might potentially fall within the definition of cluster munition. And we'll come back to some of those definitional problems a little bit later on, but they're going to be significant as the process goes forward, because while there's agreement on the upper end of what a cluster munition is, there's a lot less agreement on the lower end of what fits into it and what doesn't. But as was mentioned, Canada has either destroyed or is in the process of destroying the only two types of munitions in its arsenal that are clearly fall within this definition of cluster munitions. And those are the Mark 20 Rock Eye, which is an aircraft dropping bomb, and the dual purpose improved conventional munition, the DPICM, which is in this case an artillery launch cluster munition, which is in the process of being destroyed for operational reasons, more so than other reasons. We don't have guns that can fire. In the context of the rock, they're being destroyed, I think, more as a result of other concerns. But anyway, to the seventh stage, it's not, Canada doesn't have a vested interest in maintaining its own stockpiles of these weapons. But there are other concerns that are clearly underlying some of the treaty negotiations as we go forward. One is the ability to operate with allies. And a clear example there is our operations in Afghanistan. Canada doesn't have air support of its own in Afghanistan. We rely on the air forces, primarily the United States and the United Kingdom, and both of them use cluster munitions. And that will be a concern going forward. It's not necessarily determinative, but it is a concern to put on the table how that interoperability works with states that are either in or outside of either of these treaty regimes as we go forward. And another concern is maintaining the ability to defend the country within existing principles and future principles of international humanitarian law as they develop. There's no plan to acquire cluster munitions, but there may be a requirement to do so in the future. And Canada's committed to not acquiring weapons that have a reliability rate lower than 99%, but that's also a possibility. We don't know what the future brings, and that's a concern as we go forward in negotiations. And also underlying this is also the humanitarian concern that has already been talked about. And so bringing all those together and factoring in concerns of the numerous states that do in fact have these weapons, treaty negotiations are going to be complex as we go forward in the next year or so. So, as has already been mentioned, there are really two overarching categories of humanitarian concern with these weapons. One relating to the humanitarian problems from use of the weapon system itself, and in particular that large footprint or the large target area, and the potential indiscriminate effect of weapons, depending primarily where they're used. And that's particularly true if they're used in civilian areas, urban areas, concentrations of civilians. There's obviously a far greater concern about potential indiscriminate impact on civilians that are there. And then the second issue is the long-term impact of unexploded ordnance. The explosive remnants of war is the term that you'll see a lot. And with respect to cluster munitions, it seems like that is really it's a significant concern. And there's still UXO concerns, ERW concerns in Laos from the use of these weapons 30 years ago. So it can have a significant long-term impact. And recognizing both immediate and long-term impact of these weapon systems, both the Oslo process and the CCW have talked about working to address unacceptable harm to civilians. And that's a really important phrase, but it does present some pretty key challenges. And if you think back to what Isabella was talking about this morning, what exactly is unacceptable when you're talking about harm to civilians? The answer really isn't as easy as it might seem. As a starting point, on the one hand, all harm to civilians is unacceptable. But the reality of modern war is that civilians are not immune from the effects of conflict. And the only way to ensure the protection of civilians from the effects of war is not to go to war. But presuming that there are at times moral reasons for using military force, and I, I, I think that you can make a strong case in some circumstances, at least. Once war begins, the ideal is to avoid civilian harm and to minimize it. And the law recognizes that it's not always possible to avoid it altogether. And that gets to some of the principles that Isabel talked about this morning that come out of the specialized bodies of law, the law of armed conflict, international humanitarian law, the laws of war, and those are all effectively interchangeable concepts and terms. And importantly, that body of law, IHL, requires distinction between military objectives and civilians and civilian objects, and requires that military force be targeted only against military objectives. And so essentially, unless civilians are actually participating in hostilities, you can't target them. And to do so would be criminal. However, it doesn't prohibit any impact of war on civilians, and that's a really important distinction to understand, because that's unrealistic in many armed conflicts. Instead, what the law says is that when you're attacking lawful military objectives, the expected incidental impact on civilians, on civilian infrastructure, cannot be excessive in light of the concrete and direct military advantage that is anticipated in that. And here you're talking about the incidental impact of a lawful military attack. Again, the direct targeting of civilians, unless they're participating in hostilities, this is almost certainly going to be a war crime. Here you're talking about the collateral impact on civilians from what would otherwise be a lawful military strike. And that can't be excessive. That collateral impact can't be excessive. And the law also says that commanders must take feasible steps when they're selecting the means and methods of war to avoid or at least to minimize that collateral effect. So really, there are three principles or three broad themes. You need to distinguish between military objectives and civilians. The impact must be minimized to the extent feasible. And in any event, it must not be disproportionate or excessive. That's sort of the legal regime that governs the application of military force. And those obligations exist both as a matter of existing treaty law and as a matter of existing customary international law. And I think there's no doubt about that. And arguably, if those were complied with, if that existing law was complied with, many of the problems, if not most of the problems that we're talking about with respect to the use of cluster munitions and other munitions, would have been avoided and would be avoided. But the specific question then becomes with cluster munitions is if or how they may be used in compliance with those existing principles of international humanitarian law. And there is, again, a very clear humanitarian concern with this particular weapon system or some types within this category. It seems fairly clear that some of this broad category are unlikely to be able to be used in compliance with existing principles of international humanitarian law. The older ones, the lower tech ones in particular, and an example noted in the context of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia recently was the ORCAM rocket system. Now, in this particular context here, the weapon was fired at maximum range, and it was fired at a civilian area. So there are other problems as well. But that might be one example where, you know, a court has already spoken on this being an indiscriminate weapon. But there are many others that are far less clear that their use is inherently going to lead to indiscriminate or unlawful impact. And this is where negotiations are going to be extraordinarily difficult, is figuring out how to weed those out that are clearly outside of the bounds of international humanitarian law from those that do have some military utility and military utility in a way that can be done using conformity with existing law. Humanitarian concerns are incredibly important when we're talking about all of this.
But they're not the only concern in treaty negotiations and in decisions to use force in the context of international or non-international armed conflict. There is, in some cases, significant military utility to some types of cluster munitions. Against armored columns in the open, absolutely. That's what a large number of these systems were designed to address. Partly, it was mentioned to cover a number of targets in one pass, but also because they're moving targets. And so this gives a far greater opportunity to hit those targets within the area that you are attacking. And if you know that there are not civilians in that area, then that is likely not an indiscriminate attack, an unlawful attack. There are also other types of cluster munitions that are used for things like denial of airfields. Making little pock marks across an airfield that you can do with cluster munitions is extraordinarily effective in denying the use of that airfield for enemy forces. Similarly, countering batteries and artillery fire from an enemy is another example where this type of weapon might be of some significant utility. But that utility and the humanitarian impact often depends on the manner of use and the type of weapon. Some are more accurate, some are more reliable than others. And again, weeding those out is going to be a real problem. With many of these, there is a serious explosive remnants of war concern. And I don't think anybody's going to deny that. But ERW concerns alone, again, aren't determinative. It may be that there is a higher explosive remnants of war impact with this type of weapon, but a less significant impact on civilians at the time of use. Now, if you're talking about a conflict where the application of force is necessary, you need to balance different types of weapon system. And if you take away any weapon that has a number of smaller submunitions, then what you're left with is having to blow up what you're trying to blow up with single shots. And those are bigger, and they tend to pack a far greater explosive content and can have a significant detrimental impact on the civilians in the area, as well as civilian infrastructure. And so when you're looking at the impact on civilians, well, it is, in at least some circumstances where it's foreseeable, important to look at that long-term impact. It's also important to assess it in total. What is the civilian impact going to be, and how does it weigh against that military utility when you're making that sort of determination? Again, it's not easy. In the end, I think the key issue is going to be, or a key issue, will be just what is it that we're talking about? How do you define cluster munitions? And this is where there's some debate about ban versus regulation and so on. A lot of that debate hinges on what you're talking about. If you're only talking about the worst of the worst, then the word ban is much easier to use. If you're talking about anything that has more than one explosive submunition, then ban is probably not going to be feasible if you're talking about an instrument that states are actually going to be able to comply with in the context of armed conflict. At the high end, virtually everybody can agree. Now, if you're talking about the multiple launch rocket system that you saw a picture of, where 12 rockets can fire something like 7,800 submunitions into an area, that's pretty clearly a cluster munition. If you're talking about non-explosive munitions that have compartments like propaganda leaflets, like chaff, like electronic countermeasures, like there are a number of things that would fit in there. It's arguably a cluster munition, but banning it is probably not on. And there's a lot in between that. There are weapon systems that have 10, 12, 9 explosive subcomponents that arguably they're cluster munitions, but do they have an inherently discriminatory impact on civilians? Arguably not. And again, you'd have to look at specific impact of specific weapons. But it's a lot of this change on what it is exactly that we're talking about. And it's not clear yet nobody is really, there's been no agreement yet on what exactly a cluster munition is in negotiations. And saying that, you know, saying that definitional issues are going to be really important really annoys non-lawyers. It's, I think, sometimes viewed as stalling or you know, throwing roadblocks up in a negotiation process. But I think that this audience, out of many, will appreciate the importance of definitions in a process where the effect is not simply academic. Where the impact is going to lead to state responsibility in cases where international law is violated. And it may lead to individual criminal responsibility. And so we need to be very, very clear and very, very precise about what is permitted and what isn't. Because we need to actually give specific guidance to our military forces in the field, as to other states, about what they can and cannot do. And so, well, there's clear agreement on the humanitarian impact of some of these weapons. So that's not enough to say that we need to then get into the details. And sadly, here the devil's going to be in those details. And it will be a real challenge. Anyway, we're Canada is addressing these issues in both the CCW process and the Oslo process, and has committed to both of those processes. Not necessarily committed to the result, you know, that's part of the ongoing negotiation process, but committed to the process. But there are key differences here about and that underline the rationale for maintaining involvement in both of those processes. It's true, I think, and difficult to argue against the characterization of the Oslo process as having more momentum, that it is building towards what states have already committed will be a treaty. Aspirationally, at least in 2008, the expectation is that negotiations will finish in Ireland in May. But there are a lot of states that aren't participating in that process. United States, Israel, Russia, China, the key users and the key producers of these weapons aren't there. CCW, on the other hand, is 102-103 states parties to this regime, including all the major weapons producers, including all the major weapons users. And while it's slower and it's a consensus-based process, there is still value in engaging those states as well in the discussions. And we'll know, hopefully in November, whether there's an actual mandate to actually negotiate a treaty there. Anyway, the key will be negotiating this in a way that addresses unacceptable harm to civilians, while at the same time balancing those military concerns and ensuring that states that use these weapons are actually going to commit to any resulting treaty. And that is going to be much easier said than done. And I look forward to talking about this.
The next panel speaker is Mario Kucholic. He is a person who immigrated from Vukovar, Croatia, and he became a cultural competency trainer across Nova Scotia, working with YMCA, and he has experience and has been and super in work in his original country and be a soldier in that region.
Thank you. I can see that his time's up. Can you please? Yes, for a long time, I refused to talk about war and all this stuff because you can see, you know, from my background. I was a soldier, I was a police officer, I was a teacher, I was everything. before and after the war, and it's a very strange situation for me today to be here with all of you, and with some people who are involved in conflict for Yugoslavia. And I just found out that Mr. Itani, he was exactly in my city just a year or 2 years after the war. I was born there in the hospital. and it was very, very interesting to be here with all of you. I thought what I should say today to you. We had the opportunity today to hear experts from different fields. I'm not an expert by any means. But what I had opportunity, and I can say that I was lucky or what, but I had opportunity to be in country with before the war, during the war, and after. And now, even name that this doesn't exist. No even name. So it's kind of weird to talk. And I heard you today, talking about different kind of munitions and class of munitions and what is appropriate, what is not appropriate, what is, To me, what is different between one bullet or 100 kilograms bomb? From technical point of view, it's huge difference. From victims' point of view, and families, they don't care. It's one bullet or... So it's kind of question, is it appropriate if somebody dropped bomb, 100 kilograms and destroy complete building, or the class of munitions around, 1 mile, square 1 mile. That's very key to say there. But anyway, before the war I was a teacher. I had normal life. Nothing special but normal life. Then, during the war, I found myself in a situation that you have to take a side or you have to leave. At that time, unfortunately or fortunately, who knows, I didn't have the chance. So I had to be there. And I had the opportunity to see, from my point of view, what is war? And what does it mean when first neighbors or family members start killing each other? This is something unbelievable. So I had the opportunity to see and hear media's reports. I don't want to say that CNN or whatever, doesn't matter. And it was almost always, from one point of view, it's one side, it's always good and bad boys. In real life, again, it's just my opinion. In real life, there's no good and bad boys. During the war, there's no rules. And we can talk here, and we have experts here, Geneva, and all that. During the war, there's no rules. Special when people are scared. If somebody coming to kill you, you have to protect yourself, your family. How you will do that is another question. So I had privilege to see how normal, everyday, average people will convert over the night in killers. It's unbelievable. And it's really hard to find here, anywhere, some books or something about that. Why is it happening? Why? Explanation is very simple. Before you make any statement about something, you have to know something about history. What's happened before? For many people, they said, I don't care. This guy killed that one, and it's fact, and it's true. But why he or they did that, it's another story. And it's not black and white. Never. It's during the war and after the war, they're all victims. All. So today, from my point of view here, I came to Canada with my family eight years ago, and I'm a Canadian citizen, and it's like a weird feeling that I have accent and I became accent for the rest of my life. But when I went first time 4 years ago back, you know, they told me that I have accent. So what are you talking about? So it's like I'm nowhere, you know, I'm nowhere, basically. And especially my wife's situation, it was even worse because her father was Serb and her mother was Croat. At that time, it's worst possible combinations there. Everybody hates you. Everybody. And some people here, they're very familiar, I believe, with that. So it was one more reason to come here, because absolutely there's no future. But one point is war, but another thing is after. There's like no more healing, but still, it's just impossible to live. So we don't have enough time here. You know, I can talk. I would like to talk in a couple of days about that. But today, when you're talking about Canada, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and all this stuff, it's just maybe because I had enough in my life. I saw enough blood for the rest of my life, so I don't need that anymore. So my question is just very similar. Usually, you know, we have high politics, you know, interest or whatever. But beside that, usually it's simple things. Why people killing each other? Why wars? Why? Why does it happen? And my question is, because I believe that I'm Canadian, technically, at least, you know, even a couple of times, you know, when I spoke with some people about just simple things like mortgage or something, you know, I said, oh, if you don't like, you always can go back. I said, yeah, it's true. So, you know, but just my basic question is, why and what Canadian soldiers doing in Afghanistan? It's just simple. I heard and I know, but it's just why and what and what is point and how many people must die for something. This is just a very, very simple question. And I know that it's so many things behind and beside it. So many. And I'm just trying to ask a very simple question. Why and why there? Because what, from my point of view, before the war, what was Switzerland in Europe? It was Canada here. Peaceful. Said, oh, Canada, oh yeah. So now I'm not sure. I'm not sure anymore. But it is different time. So I will just stop here. And if you have any question later, I'll be glad to answer if I can.
Speaker,
for the question, please. Mr. Mitrovich, you said there are no rules for war. When you were a soldier, did you kill any women? Did you kill any children? Did you kill any prisoners? If you didn't, why didn't you?
Thank you for that question. I'm proud to say that I didn't. I have to say that I had opportunity many times. I didn't. Actually, what I did, it's almost almost my people killed me, because what I did, I did actually opposite things. I saved at least 20 people from certain death, from certain. Even at that time, that means that you are in serious trouble. Just do that. But somehow, I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago that during the war, it's not natural. This is a kind of special time, and people really change. And to stay normal
It's not easy task. So why I didn't? First of all, probably nobody from my family, I mean, my relatives, was killed, probably, because of that. Second reason is that my nature, my personal nature, is not wild. All my life, maybe because I'm Libra, I don't know, but all my life, I'm trying from, when I was 10 years old, I was smallest and child in my class. Anyway, and everybody, you know, and maybe from that time, you know, I developed something myself that I would like always to help somebody. And at that time, during the war, to help somebody, it's a huge, huge thing. And I had some conference maybe several months ago, and this question, you know, what was your best achievement or something like that? And I said, oh, I'm proud. I saved some lives. This is, and I'm satisfied with that for the rest of my life, with that, because I saved them. Even they don't know who I am. They never realized, and it doesn't matter. And it's a really good question. So many times I saw people around that they're doing something what is just not normal. Some of them, I know that people, that we were in the same class, high school, something. But during the war, something happened. It's really hard to explain exactly what. Exactly what, something, you know. Not all, but some of them, yes. And it's nothing to do, I can tell you, from my experience, nothing to do being Serb, being Croat, being Muslim, being Iraqis or whatever. This is human nature. Some can handle, some can't. It's too much pressure. And we are not all the same. I don't know, I was satisfied with my answer.
You, if I may elaborate on
that
a bit, obviously, you held some values, which even in that kind of a situation, and don't you think others can do the same?
Let's say if you have 10 people, and if only one, or 100, or 1,000, or 1,000,000, if just few of them start doing this, you know, then for most people, here in the United States, Canada, whatever, they said, oh, they did that. And it's instantly, you know, they will blame all. And I know, I never had problem. Usually people from former Yugoslavia, you know, Serbs, Croats, Muslims, you know, they always blame, you know, if you're Serb, I will blame everybody else. And opposite, you know. I always try to find this balance. I said, oh yeah. And I know very well history, my history, very well. And I can tell you that I'm not proud about Serbian history many times. I'm not afraid to say that. But in the same time, I can say I'm really proud. And I never had a problem when I came here 8 years ago to say I'm Serb. And still, it's like knife. You know, it's like not proper. You know what I'm saying? It's normal. And even today, I have to say, I just received that book over there. Thank you. That book, and I had just opportunity, you know, lunchtime, just, you know, and I can see that book. For most of you, you will see blood, dead people, and you will see how many times you will find Serbs. And it's normal reaction that most of you said, what the hell is going on? They did everything. And yes, many times they did. Many times, in same time, somebody else did that. But sometimes you cannot find that. And it's no reason to say, oh, because of them.
No. I'm just trying to say that sometimes balance is everything in life. You have to find balance. It's nothing black and white. It's always something.
If I could maybe follow up on that as well, just in the...
Could I apologize for doing this. I really do. There is a reason for it. I was in the Book of Order in 1993. The entire city took this time. And you were you a Serb soldier in Book of Order?
Are you familiar with the area?
Yes.
Book of Order and yes. So, one village, it's called Bershani. I don't know. And I'm here to anyone here. It doesn't matter. It's just, let's say, 10 miles from Book of Order. I was born there. I mean, my house is there. And all the time I was there, my house there. I was there all the time. And from my point of view, what's happened there, and just 10 miles further, in Vukovar and around, and Ovčara, and all this stuff, I know everything. I mean, I know most of that stuff. Most of that. I heard and I knew after, not that time, you know, but I know. And I can tell you that if that mean anything to anybody here, I'm really sorry what Serbs did there, because they're not Serbs. I mean, in turn, you know what I'm saying? I'm really not proud because what they did, they shot civilians.
Yeah, the hospital master.
Yes, that's true.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. I think there's a broader theme here that goes into all of what we've talked about already, and a lot of those atrocities in other wars, I mean, come from, in large part, a lack of control of commanders over their own forces, a lack of training of those forces, and often a lack of understanding of those military forces, that they're undermining their own mission by doing what they're doing. And from the Canadian forces' perspective, there's a real recognition of the need for that, and the need in both training in IHL and ensuring compliance. And compliance can be assured in a number of ways. And I can assure you, when soldiers step beyond that line, they're dealt with. And it can be a positive training, a positive reinforcement, and there's discipline, and there's criminal prosecution. And I mean, that lack of discipline and control we saw in Somalia. Canadian forces are not immune from this, but there is a real effort to employ those laws and a real recognition that that's a limit that we have accepted as a matter of law will be complied with. And that goes to the broader issue here, why it's important to get those rules right, that one just doesn't sign up to rules, because it's a nice thing to do to sign your state's name to a treaty. But you've got to actually get them right so that you can comply with them and still do your job effectively when called upon to do it. And that tension is not an easy one to address.
Yes. I'm just quick, you know, from your point of view, you said soldiers, you must handle, you know, but in many cases, there are no officials, there are no soldiers. You know what I'm saying? And sometimes people cannot handle fear. Fear is very important word during the war. Fear, to be killed.
This is just maybe diverting the discussion back to Western conditions or Western. This is going to be really brief. I was just wondering, most of the photos we saw of these submunitions, they were all sort of a green, dark color. That thing is that the way they normally are? And I'm just wondering, is there an issue with people, really practical question, I suppose, but is there an issue with most of the injuries that are caused by
civilians running into these? Is this a question of people not seeing them, or is this a question of people running into them? Like, I'm just wondering from a practical perspective whether or not neon or something.
It's, I think there's a tension on both sides. Correct me if I'm wrong. And there's an argument on both sides. I mean, part of it is that they're not seeing it, they're buried or what have you, and some are. They're various colors. But a concern exists on the other side that they're too attractive and they're too visible and they look too much like toys. And so the casualties with this weapon system, particularly explosive remnants of war casualties, are disproportionately children in relation to other types of munitions. And that's in large part because they're attractive. And so there's a real challenge. I mean, do you make them visible so people don't step on them accidentally? That's great, but then create this other problem.
So you have an education program as well.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, like that Chris said, there's over 200 different kinds of submunitions, and they all have different shapes, sizes, and colors. So there is, but it's not a direct correlation. And I think, yeah, like it is one issue, but it's not an issue that could probably be, in terms of impact, could be put down to either attractiveness and or like camouflage. Like that's not really the issue. It's the volatility.
And so in your group's opinion is that can't be addressed technologically?
No. We don't think there's any technical solution, technical fixes to cluster munitions that would, at least the ones that were, you know, the most unreliable and accurate, that would be satisfactory to our community.
I want to dive into just a really quick follow-up here. Is that you described a few things, possibly legitimate uses for them, for example. I'm not actually using the civilian area, fault on the spectrum, things are clearly wrong. And on the other side, there are things, for example, disabling the airfield, which may be used in a practical, conventional, and symmetrical work. But is there, obviously that isn't the case, like that's not the concern there. So how do you, you know, I'm just wondering what the approach is, how you're getting to a point, how a treaty can ever, address that sort of a.
Well, I mean, not to prejudge the outcome, but there are treaties that don't absolutely ban the use of particular weapons, but restrict their use in particular circumstances. One of the protocols to the CCW addressing the use of incendiary weapons that includes fire, limits its use in civilian areas, particularly when it's dropped from the air.
Limits its use in civilian areas.
Yes, not to civilian areas. And so there is that possibility of addressing the use.
Why does that work and not the other rules regarding, like clearly that those rules haven't worked for cluster munitions, so I'm just wondering what the difference is.
Well, those rules aren't as clear for cluster munitions. I mean, the general legal standard is there that I would suggest would preclude the use of cluster munitions in civilian areas in all but the most extreme circumstances anyway. Quite apart from any need for it, any treaty. That most of the time there are going to be disproportionate humanitarian impacts from that use. So as a general rule, I think across the board weapon system, it's going to be harder to justify use in a civilian area. With incendiary weapons, there is an actual separate treaty. That then focuses on that particular use rather than seeking to ban the use of that weapon outright.
So you don't think it's a manufacturing issue, then you believe it's a question of treaty rather? Like,
I think all of those factors would need to be looked at in concert. I mean, there are, the Canadian position again is if ever there were a need to acquire weapons in the future, it would be looking at reliability, right? The reliability rate of 99% of the rate. So there is that technological side, but then its use would be governed by general, even if there is no treaty adopted, its use would still be governed by all of the existing principles of international humanitarian law that would render it unlikely that the use in built-up areas would be longer. You know, and so that's already there.
But it's failed.
It hasn't failed from Canadian use.
Okay.
I mean, there are certainly states that have used these weapons in situations where they almost certainly should not have. That it's very difficult to view them as anything but unlawful. So yes, has it prevented humanitarian concerns outright?
Yeah.
Yeah. Specific to the crest, being the judge advocate general.
Not the judge.
No. Like yesterday, I talked to US General here, whether we need to be mistaken judging the people in Iraq, their life, liberty, but they didn't like the idea of freedom. Tomorrow, eventually, there's a statement from Afghanistan that, since the historical perspective says, you know, whenever the foreigner has gone there, he has to come back somehow or the other. So, is there any, like, prosecution for the people who went as a coalition army there, you know, after, you know, massacring, like, hundreds of people, even more than the 9/11, you know, like, 100 people was enough. Thousands of people have been killed in pursuit of that. So what will be the future strategy for if says, okay, you know, it was another mistake that we went there now. So this kind of a scenario.
It's a big question, and there are a couple of levels to it. I mean, on the criminal responsibility for the waging of war itself, I mean, setting Iraq aside, we're not there, and there are very strong legal arguments for Canadian forces' presence in Afghanistan. Initially, self-defense, in collective self-defense in relation to 9/11, but now there's a clear UN mandate to be operating there in support of an elected democratic government, which is what makes that now a non-international operation, likely because it's operating in support of that government. But in the conduct of the operation itself, whether you're talking Afghanistan or Iraq, not all, and I don't mean this to sound flippant because it's not meant that way, but not all civilian deaths are criminal. They're an unfortunate byproduct of war. I think one needs to distinguish the states that are acting in the conflicts in which these things are occurring. And there are some concerns about the use of air power in Afghanistan. But one would need to step back and look at specific attacks and say, what was being attacked? What was the anticipated military advantage from that attack? What was the expected effect on civilians? And viewed in that way, was the anticipated effect on civilians excessive? And that's what's going to tell you whether you've got an indiscriminate, unlawful attack. And if you don't have that, then you have, again, not to be flippant, then you've got an unfortunate but not criminal result. If there is, on the other hand, criminality, if there's the launching of indiscriminate attack, then there are ways, both national and international, to address that, through courts martial and the military justice process, through domestic criminal law more broadly, potentially through international fora as well. But that, one needs to make that distinction when you're looking at what happens on the ground. You have to look at the broader context, and you've got to work through the law, and it's that's an area where I think the media doesn't necessarily do a service to what's happening on the ground. That too often there's the implication that civilian deaths are automatically unlawful. Well, unfortunate, that's not the case.
I don't know how clearly articulated this question is going to be, but it came up in the context of some of the discussion we had in the copy and some of the earlier discussions about the nature of warfare and change and the nature of globalization and how it's breaking down the barriers to statehood. And how, I guess, how do we reconcile the fact that many non-state actors are using cluster missions and many non-state actors are engaging in warfare? How does IHL, whether it's legal fiction or what is it, how do we deal with the fact that the nature of war is changing and the Oslo process or a particular convention may or may not and likely will not affect the behavior of non-state actors and even state actors within the regime that aren't well trained, I guess, or whatever it is. I just wonder how it's going to work.
I could speak to that. First of all, I want to clarify that there actually hasn't been a lot of non-state armed reviews of cluster munitions. Hezbollah was the first to confirm these, and then I said there's been two other allegations documented by Human Rights Watch, but they've been never proven. So we have a concern about proliferation, but by at this particular time, thankfully, like use of cluster munitions by non-state actors is not the norm. In terms of engaging non-state actors, you know, that aren't recognized group and treaty processes, probably the best example I can give you is what's happened with the Ottawa Convention banning impersonal landmines. There is an organization, it's one of the campaign members called Geneva Call, that basically, and it's I think similar to some of the IHL education that goes on with non-state armed groups, basically engages these groups in a non-political, non-neutral way and basically educates them about the provisions of like and the obligations under the treaty. And essentially sometimes it's been used as confidence building measures between two non-state armed groups. The education that you know abide with has now become, you know, basically a normalized kind of stigmatization of the use of the weapon. And if they want political credibility in the future, you know, then just kind of working with them and encouraging them to abide by both IHL and some of the provisions under the Ottawa Treaty. And there has been, although non-state armed groups, you know, there's more non-state armed groups using anti-personnel landmines than there are states. We have seen some progress made. There's also Geneva Calls made a voluntary kind of a deed of commitment. So they cannot sign the Ottawa Treaty, because of course they're not a recognized state. But there are different tools in place to engage in a dialogue and have them commit, you know, like Tamil Tigers committed in Sri Lanka to, you know, basically voluntarily abide by the obligations set under the Ottawa Convention. So there's no simple answer, and there's no easy answer, and there's no binding answer, but there is a dialogue both through IHL discussions, and definitely there's a mechanism unofficially, people that work on the implementation of the Ottawa Treaty to engage non-state armed groups and inform and educate and work with them on what the obligations are and why it would be in their best interest to, you know, respect IHL and respect different international law like this.
And just to follow up on that, and I agree with all of that, that yeah, a lot of these obligations apply to non-state armed groups already, right? It's not that you need them to sign on to it for them to be bound for a lot of the principles of IHL. You may need them to agree in practice, right? But in as a matter of law, they're bound, which gets you somewhere, at least it gets you a bit of pressure that one can put on these groups to comply, that then feeds into all the factors that have already been raised. And it does lead to the possibility of their prosecution at the end of the war, which isn't a totally effective deterrent, but that is an option at least as well to address post-facto the worst abuses.
Yes, I'm just curious that you know, if cluster munitions are deemed in some situations to be necessary, who then, you know, in times of war, who then, after that war has subsided or diminished somewhat, who then is accountable for the cleanup? I think we were saying it takes something like 20 to 80 hours for a cluster bomb. Well, my mom always told me that if I dropped something, I was responsible for picking it up. So, the situation is accountable.
Well, that's a good question, and then there really is no good answer. The one progress, you know, which we consider a good first step, but not a complete step, that the CCW made over the past 6 years is Protocol 5 on explosive remnants of war, which does contain voluntary provisions for providing maps and for responsibility of cleanup. Now, that's voluntary, and actually Canada's not a part of that protocol right now. They're not. but the problem is with that it's voluntary and there's no enforcement mechanism. So, I mean, it's a problem that you grapple with, and then like under the Ottawa Convention, you have a responsibility to clear your own territory, whether you were the ones that mined your territory or not. But it's countries' obligations, like Canada's other state parties to the Ottawa Convention, to provide financial and technical assistance. So there's provision under the Ottawa Convention for certain cleanup. There's some voluntary provision under Protocol 5 under the CCW. But there is no easy answer to that, and how retroactive it would be, because, you know, we have landmines, et cetera, from World War II that are still around. So that is an issue, but there are some small provisions, and there, you know, I would hope there would be provisions for technical and financial assistance in any new treaty on clusters.
Yeah.
We've talked about technical solutions here. I wonder if you could clarify Mines Action Canada's position. Have you abandoned the concept of advocating for technical solutions to reduce the humanitarian impact caused by cluster munitions, or is it just one of those problems that's on the back burner?
No, I think, like, especially what we've seen in southern Lebanon with the self-destructive missiles, which were advocated as one of the technical solutions, and it had a publicized 1-3% failure rate. I guess for us, it wouldn't just be Mines Action Canada, it would be the Cluster Munition Coalition. We haven't seen enough evidence or proof of any promising technical solutions, nor would we want time to be spent improving existing weaponry, because we actually don't think that is the core of the problem, is the use of the weapon. But one thing to point out about the smarter cluster munitions that were used in Lebanon with these self-destruct is that in the field, their failure rates were much, much higher than the 1-3%. They were up to 15% and 20%. And Norwegian People's Aid, which is the largest humanitarian demining organization in the world, actually took a scientist who worked on them in Norway to Lebanon, who had done the studies, and the failure rates, to us, the burden of proof is not there for the states. The 1-3 failure rates happen in perfect, pristine conditions that are tested in a laboratory. And when they took this scientist that actually had worked and had tested these weapons to Lebanon to see the amount, and there are a large amount of failed munitions with self-destruct mechanisms. Like, even he came back and presented actually to the Oslo conference that in fact they were mistaken, and that they didn't account for the reality of what happens in the field, like soil conditions, weather conditions, etc. So to invest further in us is not the most expedient way to prevent further suffering. And that's kind of our line. We don't think that there's not a technical solution that's been presented. And this was very similar arguments that happened at the beginning of negotiating for the landmine treaty. You know, do we want to advocate for like smarter landmines? For us, that's not the most expedient, effective way to address the humanitarian concerns with cluster munitions.
If I can just follow up, it just seems to be a gap here, because we're talking about the Oslo process, which was all, as I understand, a complete ban on cluster munitions. How would you define?
No.
No.
Right now, we are calling for a ban on the most unreliable and accurate, and basically what the community, both the civil society and the government community that are part of the Oslo process, is we're in the process of deciding what that is. So no, it is not a complete ban. However, civil society is going to push for the burden of proof to be on the states. If you want something excluded, a certain type of munition, then the burden of proof is on the government to prove that it is not going to be excessively harmful to civilians. Inherently unreliable and inaccurate.
So
that's where the tension between the dialogue exists.
So if in Canada's situation, like your penny brought up, if in the future a new cluster type munition was developed with reliability of X, it would be up to the states to maintain within the confines of whatever treaty would be established that such use could possibly be.
Yeah, well, I think the burden of proof, yes, is on the states. Like, we don't know what will be developed in the future, which is why the conversation is so difficult, and Isabel is more of a legal expert, perhaps you can weigh in. But yeah, I think the bar is set much higher from civil society, and we are asking states to, if there's going to be exclusions, then the burden of proof is on them to prove that these will not cause excessive harm to civilians.
And that obligation is actually already there. An additional political one is a weapons review obligation. When states introduce new means and methods of warfare to ensure that those comply with their general obligations. So there isn't a cluster munition specific one, but there is an obligation that when you're bringing new things online, that you go through that process, whether it's a formal process or an ad hoc process, to ensure that that the use that you intend to put it to is in compliance with IHR obligations, which then feeds into doctrine about when that weapon will be used and when it won't be, and so on. Because not every weapon that is possessed by Canada or other states would be used in any situation, and different weapons have different specific purposes. And so that process goes into it. So it's a good one.
I wonder if I could ask the last question, and it's not going to be a legal one, because I'm very curious to understand I mean, it seems to me that you can have weapons that are perfectly legal, which some people said that anti-personnel mines were, only if they had been, if the rules had been followed and implemented, you wouldn't have had the results. We're hearing the same thing around cluster munitions. Isn't there a policy consideration or decision that, you know, our politicians can make based on the stigma attached to the weapon and the picture that we're seeing, and kind of surely you don't want to be associated with this type of argument? That I'm curious to understand if that's coming out of anywhere. And I know a lot of dedicated government officials at Foreign Affairs and DND are working on these issues, but where is the political engagement? We've got a new Minister of Defense, we've got a new Minister of Foreign Affairs. How engaged and aware are these ministers of these issues?
I
start writing letters.
What the ministers know and what they don't, but I think that the parallel with Ottawa is striking. But before I get there, though, if you put up pictures of victims of miniature munitions, that'll be pretty horrific too. And so, that's not the only concern. But the parallels with any personnel landmines in that process, I think, are quite striking. And one thing to be aware of with the Ottawa process in the end, it's not a ban on all landmines.
No.
It's a ban on non-command detonated anti-personnel landmines, right? And so during the negotiations, those distinctions were made. So it's still, so the weapons with the worst humanitarian effects were recognized by states and dealt with, while still allowing militaries to use landmines where they are able to detonate themselves rather than waiting for the victim to detonate them, like the claimers, and where it excluded vehicle anti-vehicle mines, mines other than anti-personnel weapons, which are still being dealt with in various processes pretty slowly. But so that may well be what you see here, is that as the process goes forward, those nuances get built into that allowed you to address humanitarian concerns while still allowing militaries to do their jobs in a way that's awful.
I guess I was just thinking of a little project for Salsa in terms of having a minister who has a broad constituency in this province who's now leading D&D.
I just want to add a point of clarification to what Chris said about Protocol 1 and the regime that would examine the new weapons being brought into the system. If you want to know more about this, ask Isabel, because she had the lead in helping the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Department of National Defense come up and design a system where Canadian military would follow a process of examining new weapons being brought into the system. So Isabel and her colleague Eladio Mayoro, who just came out of Geneva with a master's in international law, on that particular Article 36 of Protocol 1, I think you'll find it very interesting.
That's an offline discussion.
Thank you very much. It's 2:30, the time for the break. And
well, just one moment. Just again, want to thank all of our speakers.
Tokens of appreciation. I can't say that we're saving the best speaker for last, because we've had some fabulous speakers today, but I can say that the wait is worthwhile, and that Mr. Itani's presentation for us after break will, I'm certain, will be outstanding. So again, we have coffee and tea and snacks upstairs just outside the library, and we'll be returning for our final presentation of the day. Well, that's what I'm talking about. I think that's the